Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
If our timing has worked out properly and we're dropping these in the right order, of which there is no guarantee, this will be the first release of January.
Awesome.
Very good.
It's going to be a good year.
It is. It is. I'm excited. There's a lot of brewing trends for us to complain about this year.
Yes.
Woohoo!
Even if it was the best brewing trend year ever, I'd find something to complain about.
Oh, of course. Of course, we have to. That is what we're here for.
That's what we're here for. Yep. So, lots more things for growers to learn in terms of techniques and, you know, what did we do last year or what are we going to do different this year?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of good stuff.
And having some fun along the way, of course.
Of course.
And how better to start the new year than intro music? Housekeeping. So a lot of stuff coming up. Mm-hmm. 2020 will be the first year of the beginning of our Hopnology live interactive workshops. We mentioned this on the last podcast, and watch for details coming soon on registration. But mark Saturday, February 22nd on your calendars if you're in Central Standard Time. If you're in other parts of the world, it might be on Sunday, but we'll get that information to you as we have it. And something special for our patrons. So if you're a patron, you'll get a little extra bonus there if you register for the workshop.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another workshop coming up. James is going to be in Nebraska.
I am. It's my favorite workshop, my favorite conference in the U.S. to go to. In the middle of the country, it's the Combined Growers and Brewers Workshop, and this is my fourth year going. So tons of fun there. People are fantastic, and the interaction is great. And I think I've got three talks this year. Yeah, over 2 days.
Nice. And that's January 27th and 28th, the Nebraska Grower and Brewer Conference.
Yep. It's in Lincoln. So,
Lincoln.
Yep.
Nice. And if you're a $10 patron on Patreon, James will provide turndown service if you're at this conference.
You bet. Mm-hmm. Just let me know where you're at.
So all the more of a reason to get on board with that, get a little personalized service,
mm-hmm.
and order him around a little bit. He'll tuck you in and everything.
You bet. Read your stories.
I've been saving that one.
I will read from my favorite physiology textbooks. You'll be asleep in seconds.
Always good to give you an easy path to sleep with some science and made-up words.
Yep. Lots of made-up words.
Great, great. All right, so we've got a couple of different things to talk about today.
We do.
You want to start with some science-y stuff?
Yeah, let's talk about more made-up words right off the bat.
All right.
How about nitrate poisoning?
Ooh.
Right? In people. Nitrate poisoning. So for those of you who may not be aware, there's a significant concern amongst some countries and in like the U.S., states within the country, that about excess nitrate applications leaching into the groundwater. And that could be from high-intensity agriculture as like a fertilizer, but also about leaching from manure applications. If you live in Wisconsin, it's a big, big issue for us because, frankly, all those dairy cows make a lot of poo and it has to go somewhere, so we land spread it. But just because it's poo doesn't, and we, you know, it's good, quote, fertilizer, doesn't mean that you can just keep piling it on and piling it on and piling it on. It's got to go somewhere. And true, there's a lot of nutrients in that manure, but it goes somewhere. And the soluble nutrients, like nitrates, and we all know that our hops love nitrates. They love to eat nitrates. So you're thinking, hey, this is going to be great. I'll just pile it all on. Not so much there. Just slow your roll and think about what you're doing. So I thought we ought to talk about nitrate leachage and usage in hop production and why we need to keep it out of our groundwater.
All right.
Cool.
And you said in particular there's an issue. The Netherlands is having a significant problem with this now.
Big time. Well, think about how high their water table is. And so it's very, very easy for nitrates to get into the groundwater. And when that happens, you have serious, serious health effects. Specifically, nitrites is you know, sort of the, one of the biggest issues. And nitrates can transform to nitrites in the body. But in general, and this, I don't want to go too deep down this rabbit hole, but too much nitrates in your body make your hemoglobin in your blood less likely to carry oxygen. So you can actually poison yourself on nitrates, certain, most typically from groundwater. So the fact that your hemoglobin doesn't carry enough oxygen anymore and your body doesn't function properly. So you're constantly in this oxygen deprived state. It's particularly bad in babies. And when people are using groundwater, tap water to mix formula given to babies, it can cause significant health effects where the hemoglobin can't carry enough blood. And you've probably heard of blue baby syndrome. Maybe you haven't. Nitrates and nitrites, basically, if you can't carry enough oxygen in your blood goes kind of purplish. And you take on this bluish tinge. And if you can't carry oxygen in your blood, that means you're oxygen deprived, which leads to brain damage. So is no good. Keep the nitrates out of our drinking water. Keep them in the plant where they belong. That's what our plants need. So imagine, if you will, that you're a nitrate molecule. NO3 minus. You have a negative charge. As we've talked about in the past, there's this idea of, well, the soil holds all of our nutrients, right? No, doesn't. Doesn't hold all of our nutrients. It holds some of our nutrients for plants. In particular, the ones that are positively charged, because the soil is negatively charged. And it acts like a battery, right? It holds onto these positively charged plant nutrients. Nitrate is NO3 minus, so it's negatively charged. And what happens when you put two negative poles of a magnet together?
They run away from each other.
Exactly. Phosphates are another one. Phosphorus is another one that's negatively charged. And so what happens to that stuff? They run away. They're dissolved in water. Water goes down through the soil column, right? Through something we call hydraulic pressure, hydraulic conductivity. And when it rains, that water seeps through the soil and recharges the underground aquifers. And it carries all of those nutrients with it that cannot attach itself to soil particles. If you have a lovely mix of manure, and let's say you have a manure that's particularly high in nitrates, and you spread that on the soil, and you get what we call a gully washer, right? You get the huge downpour of water, even could just be a couple of inch rainstorm. It's going to leach and wash all of those nutrients, not all, but it's going to, considerable percentage will be lost to the water, rainwater, irrigation water, whatever. And some of it will seep down into the soil and you'll lose it. Some of it will be carried off. If you've got a super high rainstorm event, it'll be carried off in the surface water and end up in lakes and rivers where you can get nitrogen and nitrate and phosphorus concentrations. That's where our giant algae blooms come from, is too much phosphorus in surface water. Again, there's a lot of phosphorus in poo. So whether you're polluting the groundwater with nitrates or you're polluting surface water with phosphorus, this stuff is all coming from agricultural runoff. Not all. A considerable part, again. I keep policing myself because I don't want people coming back saying, not all of it comes from there, James. Yes, I know that. Okay, but I'm trying to give you some orders of magnitude here. More is not better. In very few cases is more better, certainly in agriculture. But with nutrient management, more is not better. It's about the right kind of nutrient at the right time, at the right place. So accuracy, more accuracy is better, but not more volume.
And that's so interesting because we talk so often about the fact that lack of nitrogen is such a problem for hops. Mm-hmm. So the answer can vary. Very often is looked at as more nitrogen, more nitrogen, more nitrogen. But it's the right kind of nitrogen that's important here.
Correct. I've had growers they've heard me say, well, James, you said that hops only use nitrate form of nitrogen, so I'm going to use calcium nitrate as a fertilizer. Go for it. You can. But they put it all on, and they get a gully washer, and then they wonder why their plants are nitrogen deficient. It's because all that nitrate you just put on dissolved in 3 inches of rainstorm event, or 6 inches, and is gone now. Well, where'd it go? It went into the groundwater, Batman. That's where it's at. It's not available for your plant. So just because that form of nitrogen is the most readily available for hops doesn't necessarily mean it's the best choice for your overall nutrient management program. So what other options are there? Well, we talked about manure and compost, right? And how more is better, more is better, more is better. No, it's not. Because unless you have a controlled way to get those nutrients into your plant, if you're in a low water scenario like our friends in Australia dealing with their droughts right now, or if you're in a super sloppy area like Wisconsin and Tennessee and Virginia with lots and lots of water, the availability is not going to be there. So it's this for the plant. So you've got this night, you have to walk this line between, I've got enough concentration here for my plant to make use of, but I also have to have enough water in order to get it into the root zone for the plant to take it up. So if you know that you're only going to be able to apply water through irrigation because Mother Nature is not going to rain on you, that would and should inform your decision on which nitrogen to use. So at that point, you can be very pinpoint critical about what nitrogen you use and how you apply it, as long as you have the water to apply it in a drought scenario through irrigation. If you are relying on Mother Nature to deliver your water for your fertilizer and you're in a drought situation, not only are your plants going to be drought stressed, but they're also going to be nutrient deficient. Water and nutrients go hand in hand here, but too much water can cause too much leaching of those nitrates and phosphates, which ultimately pollute our water source.
So all that leaching, I mean, how do we connect that to the problems with having too much of it in the groundwater? And you mentioned the blue baby syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you want the nitrogen on your hops. You don't want it in your groundwater.
Right.
So it's using the right types of nitrogen.
Correct. So let's talk about that again. Well, just briefly here, because we've talked about it in the past, right? There's really a few forms of nitrogen that one can use. This idea of compost is biological nitrogen. It could be manure compost. It could be leaf compost, whatever it is. And you've had microbes basically suck up most of the available nitrate that leaches and lock it in their microbial bodies. So they're using that nitrogen to build proteins. It becomes unavailable for leaching at that point. So you're like, yes, all right, it's not going to leach. And I'm locking that nitrogen in my compost. Well, it's also not plant available. So now we have to, as those microbes die and they break down and they decay, nitrogen gets released as other forms. First, it's in proteins, and then it gets broken up into usually urea or ammonia forms, which those are not nitrates. Those are, instead of NO3-, it's NH3 or NH4+. So, hey, it's positively charged. That's important. So that means it's not going to leach now. If it's positively charged, that nitrogen can now be stuck to the soil complex because positive and negative charges attract. And then slowly, very slowly, that nitrogen can be transformed back into the nitrate form and then taken up by the plant. So it's sort of like nature's time-released nitrogen fertilizer. So that's the nitrogen cycle, and that's what happens when we apply compost or we're using biological sources of nitrogen. If you're using raw manure, there's going to be a big push of nitrates that come out of the animal, just like we have nitrates that humans excrete as well. Those are going to be immediately lost. Unless they can be bound up by microbes. If we get too much water applied too quickly, those nitrates are going to go into the groundwater. So it's a balance. It's a balance between having those nitrates there, but only applying enough water to get them soluble so the plant can take them up and they don't wash out of the soil. But if you're in a Mother Nature scenario, you can't control the rainfall. So you could have a huge flush of nitrates released from even those biological sources if you get a big rainfall shortly after you've applied it. Tricky. It's a tricky scenario. You have to have enough nitrogen there to keep your plants happy at the right time, but not so much that you lose it because, A, it's an environmental there's a significant environmental cost to that, but there's also an actual bank account cost to that, because you don't want to be applying nitrogen that's not going to be effective. Mm-hmm. It's just, you might as well take your cash and just throw it all over the field, because it's going to do about as good. So it's a,
how am I going to find an Instagram picture of cash all over a field?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, any farmer, you could just follow them. They hemorrhage cash as they walk across their field. Oh. So I thought it was important just to talk about that more is not better. And even if it's a biological source of nitrogen, more is not necessarily better, because they can, whether it's a conventional fertilizer or organic fertilizer, they can both equally pollute.
Yeah, that's scary stuff. That's yep. absolutely scary. It's scary stuff for the bank account, but it's scary from a health perspective as well.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and if you live anywhere where there's a lot of surface bodies of water, like around Madison, we've got lots and lots of lakes, and you can't go in them because of these giant blue-green algae blooms because of phosphorus runoff. There's, like, nitrogen in terrestrial plants, so hops, any plant growing on the ground, nitrogen is the largest limiting factor to plant growth. But that's not true in aquatic plants. In aquatic plants, it's phosphorus. So basically, we're fertilizing our lakes with phosphorus and our streams with phosphorus. And that's coming from runoff that creates massive algae blooms that consume oxygen out of the water. They can create toxic algae blooms that kill people and dogs that go into them. They kill fish and other aquatic life and just can absolutely wreak havoc. So use with caution. That's my public service announcement.
That's your warning for starting the year off right here.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay.
Sorry. Captain Bringdown away.
Oh, man. No, good, important stuff, because, you know, and we talk about this with just about everything. How do you know if you're doing it wrong? And, you know, too much, too little, it's all about understanding the science behind it.
Right.
It's so, so very important.
It is.
So thank you for sciencing us up.
You got it. I scienced the shit out of it today already.
Yes, you did.
All right.
Yes, you did.
Now you market all the right. shit out of it. What are we going to talk okay. about on your side of the fence here?
We got a couple things here, but, you know, a few weeks ago we spoke about the all ingredients issue of the Brewers Association new brewer, which was very exciting, and we talked about the trends in growing what folks are putting in the ground. So there was another article about what brewers are using and how that has changed over time, and I thought we could spend a few minutes on that.
Sure.
Because we mentioned during that discussion that Centennial finally overtook Cascade.
Right.
And that's important. So you've got Centennial, then Cascade, and then, not surprisingly, Citra, Mosaic, Simcoe, Chinook, Amarillo. The ones you expect to see.
Right.
So in 2012, I thought this was fascinating, 1 pound in every 3 pounds of hops used in brewing, so again, this is in usage we're talking now, was Cascade. 1/3 of the hops being brewed were Cascade. It's now 1 in 8, which is still substantial, considering the number of different varieties out there, but that's a huge decline in its relative use.
Mm-hmm.
The top 10 hops in use, the ones I just mentioned, they represent about 62% of the hops, the hop volume that we're using in craft brewing in North America. In North America, let me.
And Centennial, is number one.
Yes, Centennial's now number one.
Do we know what the percentage of, I mean, so Centennial's number one, how does that rate amongst the 10?
I can tell you that the top three represents 35%.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So it's pretty substantial. And that has been a consistent metric. Both the top three being 35% and the top 10 being 62% has been very consistent over the last 10 years. That has not wavered.
Right.
That said, there are more varieties in use than ever before. 163 different varieties were reported as being used by brewers. In 2009, that number was about 80.
I wonder how many of those are proprietary.
Probably a lot of them.
Yeah.
I would imagine a lot.
In the top, I'd say probably top 20, I would hazard a guess that at least half, if not more, are proprietary.
I think that is correct. I think that is correct. We talked about that last time in terms of production.
Right.
But I believe that number pans out. I don't have that here for what's being used.
That's just a total swag on my part, but just from what I see in the industry, that feels about right.
It does. And I think that the reason we've got so many more varieties in use right now is that the hop has become part of the marketing identity of the beer.
Yeah, that just blows my mind.
Mm-hmm. And I still wait for the day, we've said this before, but we don't hear that about yeast and about malt. You see a little bit of that with malt, you know, especially with darker beers. This was made with chocolate malt. Well, duh, it's brown.
And you hear it about with yeast too, in beers where the yeast is specific to the style, like a Hefeweizen.
Mm-hmm.
Right? People say this is made with Hefe yeast, whatever, because it produces banana and clove esters.
Well, you don't hear about that with any IPAs.
Exactly. It's like, nope, because they don't have sexy names either.
That's true. You know? Yeast 1, 2, 3.
Yeah, yeast AH74-0 alpha. Not so much. Doesn't roll off the tongue.
You know what? The next time we play Beer the Name with someone, I'm going to use one of those yeast names.
Awesome.
Throw it out there as Beer the Name.
Totally.
But that it is so interesting that the hops have become part of the marketing identity. And, you know, you look at the noble hops and the more classic varieties, and they're named after regions, after geographic areas.
Mm-hmm.
And the new ones are all named after, I don't know, porn stars? I don't know. you know, they're,
yeah,
they,
yeah.
There's so much more marketing ease.
You cannot. Now appearing on stage 3, you cannot.
You cannot go wrong with
you cannot
one.
Go wrong with you cannot.
It's so much part of the marketing identity, and I think that's why you're seeing so many more varieties in use. You've got that, and you've also got the beer is sexy, and hop growing is sexy, and you've got growers creating shit. And it's not, you know, a lot of it's very good, so I shouldn't say they're creating shit, but they're creating stuff. They're creating all these new varieties, also in the hopes of catching, you know, fire in a bottle and being the one to own this new proprietary variety that will set them up for life.
But there's a significant amount of marketing and market targeting that goes on to get those new varieties into the hands of people that do something with it. Remember the day when it was, oh, the way that non-traditional hop growers are going to really succeed is to come up with their own variety. We got to breed our own varieties. Right. What happened with that? Some people are still trying to do it. And the ones that even have come up with a couple, what is your ability to get that into the marketplace in a meaningful way?
You got to give a lot of it away at first.
You have to give a lot away, but it's a significant amount of effort to get those names out there. And even then, all it takes is one or two hit beers with it at the Great American Beer Festival, and you're off to the races, and there's only, you know, 100 acres of it in production. Mm-hmm. So it's akin to winning the lottery.
Yep.
So it is. I just don't see it. But anyway, we're total off topic. But
well, we're not, though. It's interesting because it's about the use of all these different varieties. And it has me jump topics a bit, but it leads to something interesting when you mention being off to the races like that. One of the points the article was making is that shortfalls and surpluses were not as big an issue as they've been in the past.
Hmm.
And, you know, we've had issues with shortfalls, some of which were not necessarily real,
right.
We'll say.
Right.
And surpluses with things like, you know, Cascade, where people, it's fallen out of favor. Falling out of favor at the same rate that it's being grown in such massive quantities. So that's been the problem there. But these shortfalls, I mean, especially the proprietary varieties, when you can't get your hands on them, it drives the price up. It's basic supply and demand. It hasn't been as big a problem the last year or two as it had been, and they didn't go into why that is. And I don't know if that's that there's more volume of these rarer varieties, or if to some degree there are so many choices that, okay, you know what, I can't get my hands on XYZ, but you know what, I can do this with ABC instead.
Mm-hmm.
And that's equally new and interesting and exciting. It wasn't the one I was planning on, but it's close enough. So I think there's a lot of more options going on right now. And you also have better expectations as a brewer that, okay, there are things I know I can't get my hands on in volumes. So if I'm going to do one beer a year with this variety, I've got to accept that that's good enough. I can't always have an IPA with this variety on tap at every given moment. I've got to make that a special thing once in a while. So I think the business is learning a bit how to handle this.
I would hope so. I mean, I'm torn a little bit by that because I still see this easy button issue of, you know, Smash Mouth hops, or it certainly isn't as Smash Mouthy as the Caddy cat piss flavored stuff from 2010 to 2015 timeframe. But so you're getting more into the melon and tropical fruit and berries and stone fruit stuff now, but brewers are still going to the hop. It's like the hop is what makes my beer special and not the whole beer itself. Mm-hmm. And that bothers me. It's
what the market wants.
Is it? If you look at these other beverages that are being produced, what that tells me is we see this strong uptick now in hard seltzers and even malt beverages that are flavored. And it's being produced and targeted to people that were buying these juicy, hazy, milkshakey things because they didn't taste like beer. Now I'm curious to see what that market segment does to change the beer that's being produced now, because brewers are trying to make beer that doesn't taste like beer for people who go to these tap rooms to drink something so that they're a part of the group culture there, but they don't like beer.
You know, I was thinking about this the other day, about this beer that doesn't taste like beer thing, because we talk about it a lot. And a place near me just bourbon aged an imperial stout and just put it out, and it's delicious.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a style that has been well accepted over a long time. And I'm sure when that was first done, people looked at it and went, what the hell? This is not beer. This is beer you're flavoring with something else. But now, it's no one's going to blink when they see a bourbon barrel-aged stout. It's a very standard category.
Correct. That's correct.
So these things do evolve.
No, and that's fine. And I'm all about allowing the evolution of the style. But I'm curious as to whether has something been lost, or are we at risk of losing brewing tradition skills because the focus has been so much on the hop for the past 20 years and not on the overall quality. I don't say quality, but the overall process and all the other ingredients that are involved. It's just we've been singularly focused on the hop, and as a result, we've doubled an industry, right? At the same time as the industry has expanded, it's channeled more and more of that expansion into proprietary lanes. Mm-hmm. And I'm concerned that the industry and the other growers out there, the non-traditional growers or anybody who doesn't have the ability to grow these proprietary ones, are not going to be able to compete, because that's where the focus is. And then secondary to that, the hops that are being bred are so over the top with their aromas that they become the beer becomes so focused on that, to your point earlier about the yeast and the malt and even the water quality takes a back seat. We run the risk of losing skill in exchange for fast and market pleasing palates that are super duper fickle.
We do. And we have to see if this is a trend with a correction, or if this is an evolution that you don't come back from.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fair concern. And it's almost like you read my notes, which I know you didn't, because you're leading me to the next topic here.
Ah.
Which is that, and this is going to make you throw up a little.
Okay.
Hopping per barrel is up 9%. So pounds of hops per barrel has mm-hmm. risen 9% since last year, and it's been rising year over year.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a combination of two things. It's going to be a combination of mix, where we're leaning more away from classic styles and into hop-heavy styles. And it also leans toward the whole, you know, hazy and super hopping things. We're over hopping not only individual brews, but the industry in general.
And that, again, blows my mind, because we have extremely good data that shows that beer is a liquid in a dry hopping scenario, literally cannot absorb more than 1.8 pounds per barrel. So if you're dry hopping at more than 1.8 pounds per barrel, you're wasting. You're wasting it. Yeah. And people think, again, more is better. It's not. You have reached the physical chemical limit of what that beer can absorb.
Yep. And again, I think some of this has to do with mix, where in a given 10 beers at a tap room, it used to be that five of them were IPAs, and now seven are IPAs, and two of those are hazy IPAs. And so your average pounds per barrel has gone up because you're pushing more hop forward.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Out there.
Gotcha. So okay.
I think there's, to some degree, what you've said is true as well. The people are just, you know, you're overhopping what you individual beers unnecessarily. But I think also the trend toward the hoppy beers, they're displacing the non-hoppy beers.
Yeah. So the overall creep of the availability.
Yes.
You know, availability, the what's on tap. So those beers are trending upwards in their hoppiness. Mm-hmm. So everybody's taste buds are burned out.
Yep. So, it's none of this is surprising. It's all interesting as a grower to say, hey, great, the hop market is there. It's there for me. But to your point, is it only there in proprietary varieties?
Mm-hmm.
And at first blanch, we'll look. Centennial and Cascade are 1 and 2. No, it's not just those varieties, except the Pacific Northwest has, as far as the eye can see, Centennial and Cascade coming out of their ears. You know, how do you get in there with your non-proprietary varieties and make an impact and get your hops into people's hands? So that's the market. That's what's happening there. What did you just say that I wrote down? Beer is a liquid. I think that was a great line. I'm going to have to use that.
Beer is a liquid. Yes.
Yeah, beer is a liquid. Thank you for clarifying that. In case anyone didn't know that, beer is a liquid.
Although some of the abominations I've seen over the last few years, I question it. It's more of a semi-colloidal suspension.
When they get chunky like that.
Blah.
Yeah, ew.
My friend of mine is a beer judge and a outstanding brewer. And he posted on Facebook the other day. He says, reading through the World Beer Cup style guidelines for light lagers, quote, flavor attributes typical of beer are usually very low when present for the light lager category. And I wrote back, I'm like, well, compared to hazy, juicy abominations, I can see that. Mm-hmm. Oh. Yeah. It's like, bleh. But it's, you know,
yuck.
I often thought, I'm like, maybe we need to have like create a Hopnology Pilsner prize and create our own contest where it's like, who can create the best Pilsner or Kolsch? Or I'm like, why don't we, if you look at the beer judging categories for Oktoberfest or for, you know, you name it, Helles or for Hefeweizen, the people doing the beer judging, if you look at the trends, they follow exactly what you said with the increase in hop usage across the board. You see them, their notes have changed over time too, where an English ESB would be expected to be at this bitterness level, right? And as the last 20 years have changed, those beers that are on the, what we would say, the low end of the acceptable range are not winning because they're just not hoppy enough.
Yeah.
And I think that's just a tragedy.
I agree. That classical style is not only not selling, but I think folks are just not looking for it anymore. And when you do look for it, it tastes plain and boring, as opposed to the Orange Julius punch in the face that you get from these other things. The market is changing. The market's absolutely changing. And for a beer purist, it's complicated.
Yeah. I'm just trying to figure out how does a grower relate all this back to what they're doing? So all this data that we gave them, you know, what does it mean for them?
Well, it means the market, you know, the hop market continues to grow. There's the ability to sell hops. But the degree to which it's owned by the big guys and owned by the proprietary varieties, I think also continues to increase. So in my mind, and this is the way you and I have always tried to run the business, is the way to do this is to sell quality. Even a hop that has fallen out of favor, if you can sell it on its merits and have a quality product, that can get you a long way.
Yeah.
And understanding what your brewers can use it in. Saying, here are my hops, they're Mount Hood, what do you use them in? I don't know.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
That's not good enough.
It isn't. No, that's a good point. And needing to be able to tell a brewer how to use the product, you're like, well, they're the brewer, they should know. Yeah, no, not really. Because maybe they've never used Mount Hood. And they're like, wow, hey, can I make a new IPA out of this? Well, you can do whatever you want, but I wouldn't. Because Mount Hood isn't going to stand up to these other compound or these other hops that you're going to put in there with your IPA, because you're going to go your smash mouth route, and that's not what Mount Hood's good for.
Yep. Think about a pharmaceutical rep who walks into a doctor's office and says, here's our new drug. It does this, 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 and this. You would use it for this. They're not a doctor, but they have to somehow convince the expert in the room, the doctor, that what they're selling is going to aid them in doing their job properly. So you really have to do the same thing. Walk in there. It doesn't mean you have to become a master brewer overnight, but it does mean you need to understand how the flavor profile, how the chemical profile of that hop will impact the product that brewer is putting together.
Right.
And that's so you're beyond just farming at that point.
And that's a big step for a lot of folks that are looking at it specifically as farming, saying, well, now I have this crop and this product and brewers are going to buy it because they know how to use it. Not really. You said there were how many varieties on that list? I mean, it's like hundreds.
163.
Right.
163 varieties in the U.S. this year in use.
And let's say 20 of them are heavily controlled by proprietary, right? But that's 20 of the 100 and whatever. So those ones that are left are still being used. You need to bone up on what they are, what their styles are, or what styles of beers they're used in, and understand that's part of how you sell to brewers, is being able to show them that you can communicate in their language.
It's tricky. It's tricky. We've talked about it before. Right, we got one more topic we can squeeze in here, I think.
Okay.
And that's what happened about a week or so ago with Ballast Point.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So Ballast Point makes the Sculpin series of IPAs. They are they were a very, very popular beer for a while. They were growing by leaps and bounds.
Yeah, they exploded.
Yep. In 2015, Constellation bought them for $1 billion. It was one of the largest acquisitions of a craft beer by a larger holding company, which was very trendy then, and it still is now. And Constellation, they do the U.S. distribution for Corona, for Modelo, Pacifico. They do a whole bunch of wines, and I think they own Cupcake, a lot of hard liquors. So they're all in, and they jumped into craft like everyone else has done. They just agreed to sell Ballast Point. Now, again, they bought it for $1 billion in 2015. It is now 2020. They are selling it for... Do I not have the dollar figure here?
I don't think it's been released, but I think...
No, I don't think it has.
From what I was reading, it was somewhere around 200, maybe no more than 200 million.
I believe you're right. It was in that range. And Ballast Point in 2016, right after they were bought, did 431,000 barrels. This year, they're looking at coming in, well, for 2019, they ended at 200,000 barrels.
Mm-hmm.
So just going down like crazy. And we've talked about scarcity and local and the fact that some of these heavy distribution craft players are having difficulty because when you walk, I think it was the owner of Stone who said this, you know, if I walk into a liquor store and I see Stone, which I can get anywhere, it's dependable and I know it, and I know it's good, and the same for Ballast Point. I can get it whenever I want, or I see something new that I'm in Connecticut. Oh, something new out of Vermont. Let's see. Huh. I'm going to try that.
Right.
So you, by getting that extra distribution and that given availability, you lose a little bit of your cachet.
And there's the blowback, too, of the hardcores that believe that craft beer is all about being independent. And then when someone gets purchased by you know, a larger conglomerate, they sell out. They're sellouts, right? Every time it happens in the industry, those people sell out. Well, as a business owner, that's sort of your one of your goals.
Yes, that is, you know, success.
Yeah, that could be determined as success if you want to do that. So you've built a brand. It now has a lot of value, more value than it had before, so you sell it. But here we have a case where Constellation said, hey, there's a huge brand here. We're going to buy it. It's worth this much money because basically our spreadsheet, we can project it out and it's linear and this is what we can do with this and this is what we're going to buy it for $1.2 billion or whatever. And it lost how much? 80% of its value or more?
Something like that. I mean, it's crazy.
In like 4 years?
And all Constellation had to do, I mean, they bought it and said, this is great. We can give them more production capacity and we can give them a distribution network that they never dreamed they'd have access to. And that's really the big thing you get from being purchased by one of these big ones is you get a distribution network. And that is incredibly expensive and complicated.
It is. But you have to do that calculus, which says, yeah, I'm probably going to lose regional sales because it's going to be available everywhere. So that scarcity is going to go down, but I'm hoping to make it up in volume.
And that did not work.
It didn't work for Ballast Point. So,
Yep. So this is this is happening. The company that bought them is a small brewery called Kings and Convicts, which is out near you.
Yeah, it's in Chicago.
Mm-hmm. They did 600 barrels last year, and they just bought Ballast Point, which is ending the year on a low of 200,000 barrels. So this is a huge pivot for Kings and Convicts to figure out how to make this work.
It's like a Hail Mary, right?
Yep.
They're swinging for the fences, and if they can connect on it, they can make serious waves. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I mean, hopefully.
It'll be interesting to see what happens. Meanwhile, in 2019, you know, Sam Adams, Boston Beer Company, bought Dogfish Head. That was huge. And they spent $300 million on Dogfish Head. Only $300 million when you think about Constellation buying Ballast Point for $1 billion 4 years ago.
Yeah, just, it's staggering. It's
amazing.
I mean, this is what drug companies are purchased for, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, Pfizer buying, you know, another drug manufacturer for billions of dollars, not a brewery.
It's hard to put those numbers into perspective. But that 300, 400 million seems to be a more normal number for some of these big purchases. So Dogfish Head went this year. Kirin bought New Belgium for about 400 in 2019.
Yeah.
And Anheuser-Busch InBev, they bought Craft Brew Alliance for $321 million. And Craft Brew Alliance owns Red Hook, Widmer, and Kona. I know you're a big Kona fan. You've been to the brewery.
Yep.
So these things are still happening. The big guys are buying these little guys, hoping to keep that little guy identity, but give them distribution in the hopes that they'll get footholds, you know, and make waves. It all comes back to consumers and that local dynamic and what's important to you. I always come back to, again, the guy from Stone talking about the fact that once you're available everywhere, you're less sexy.
Right.
And that sounds like a, you know, again, the porn movie. You know, once you're available everywhere, you're less sexy.
Starring You Cannot.
Yeah, starring You Cannot. So we're running along here. Here's the punchline to me about what Constellation just did. So I don't believe they were shopping Ballast Point around. This was the Kings and Convicts guys came to them and said, you know, we're kind of interested. And they went, huh, okay. So Constellation, again, Corona, Modelo, Pacifico, all this. They're getting rid of Ballast Point. They're launching via Corona a hard seltzer line this year. Isn't that interesting? Mm-hmm. Chasing the trend.
That went under the groundwater, Batman.